Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 8th of May. On Tuesday, the 8th of May, 1945, it was Victory in Europe Day, marking the formal end of Hitler's war.
Yesterday morning at 2:41 a.m., at General Eisenhower's headquarters, General Jodl, the representative of the German High Command, and of Grand Admiral Dönitz, the designated head of the German state, signed the act of unconditional surrender of all German land, sea, and air forces in Europe to the Allied Expeditionary Forces, and simultaneously to the Soviet High Command. Today is Victory in Europe Day. Tomorrow will also be Victory in Europe Day. But let us not forget for a moment the toils and efforts that lie ahead. Japan, with all her treachery and greed, remains unsubdued. The injuries she has inflicted upon Great Britain, the United States and other countries, and her detestable cruelties call for justice and retribution. We must now devote all our strength and resources to the completion of our tasks, both at home and abroad. Advance Britannia. Long live the cause of freedom. God save the King.
We talk about VE Day today on our program, and we have two guests with us. A World War II veteran, Gene Schultz. He is from Wisconsin, lives outside Milwaukee. He's author of the forthcoming book, The Ghost is General Patton's Army. He served in General Patton's Army and served in what was known as the Ghost Corps for the speed of its advance. He was in Washington as part of the Stars and Stripes Honor Flight Program, a wonderful program, and I believe he went a couple years ago. He will be talking about the toll that it takes for really a very young boy. He joined the fighting effort when he was a mere 19 years old. He also witnessed the discovery of the first concentration camp, which is very hard even today for him to talk about. Gene, thank you so much for being with us.
Good morning, Kathleen. It's good to be with you.
Good morning, Gene. It's a delight to have you here. Also joining us is Professor Donald Miller. He's a professor of history at Lafayette College and is an award-winning author and expert on World War II. Three of his eight books are On the War, Masters of the Air, America's Bomber Boys Who Fought the Air War Against Nazi Germany, D-Days in the Pacific, and The Story of World War II. He also appeared on the American Experience program, The Bombing of Germany. He has won all kinds of awards for excellence in teaching, fellowships from the National Endowment for the Humanities, and he also was involved in the documentary, which you can now get on, well, I think you can purchase it some way, on World War II, produced by Tom Hanks. Professor Miller, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Kathleen. It's great to be here.
Yeah, we should have a really good hour. And we welcome your phone calls during the course of this hour. Our number is 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. And you can also post comments on the Kathleen Dunn Show. Gene, let's start with you. Where were you on this day in 1945?
May 8th, 1945. I was in a small town called St. Martin, Austria. That's where our last CP, our last command post was, so the 20th Corps, and it was a beautiful and joyful day. It was a sunny, nice spring day, and we had received the order from General Eisenhower that all fighting should cease and all troops should stay in the place they were at and put down their guns. And we celebrated by I had a Jeep. My boss was a major at that time, G3 Air major, and I drove his Jeep. And so we jumped in the Jeep and took a couple other people with us, and we drove through the the Alps there. St. Martin is a town maybe 50 miles south of Salzburg. And, oh, what a glorious day it was. And we just were so enraptured with the scenery and the good news.
Mm-hmm. And how did you receive the news? Was it a radio transmission?
Well, I guess it was. It filtered down from General Eisenhower's headquarters. He sent an order to all the troops, and we got it from our company commander.
And Professor Miller, take us to various parts of this earth when the news came that the Germans had surrendered. What was happening in the United States? What was happening in England? What was happening in Germany?
Well, in England, Churchill, of course, gave that very moving speech that you just, ran on the radio. And he was held up on his way to the Commons to give the speech. And in the throngs, that crowded the streets, and people were holding up babies and screaming, Winnie, Winnie. I mean, the celebrations were incredible. I mean, Piccadilly Circus went crazy. And the same thing happened in Times Square. I think we've all seen the photographs and the films of the celebrations in Times Square. But I think, we forget about two things. I think it was a double liberation for the guys who were held behind barbed wire for years during the war. I mean, most of these prisoners are liberated, as Gene knows, within about a week before the surrender, when Patton's armies and other armies, moved toward Austria and Munich. And these guys had, there were 80,000 American airmen that were being moved from camps that were close to the Russian advance. And they'd been marching for 90 days through the heart of the Reich while the war was still on. And they finally reached a German prison camp near Munich around May 5th or 6th. Most of them were skeletons by then, human skeletons. Mm. And, so for them, it's a double liberation. For the guys in the Pacific, I mean, the announcement came in over the loudspeakers on Saipan, where our B-29s were, from which our B-29s were bombing Germany. And there was hardly a murmur there. I mean, there were really two wars. And to these guys, there was a lot of fighting left. The Battle of Okinawa, the largest battle in the Pacific, was ongoing at the time. We were taking horrific casualties. We didn't know how long the war was going to last. A lot of guys thought, we all know today, in hindsight, it's over that summer. But to the kids out in the Pacific, there was the feeling that it might last to 46, probably, might even go into 47. And a lot of guys in Europe, I've interviewed, who are in Europe, maybe Gene could talk about this, felt that, maybe this is just the beginning of a second war for them, that they were getting ready to be, a lot of them were getting ready to be transferred to the Pacific. Bombers were being sent back to the United States to be transshipped to the Pacific. So there's a sense of an ending, yes, but there's a feeling that there's a lot of fighting to go.
Mm-hmm. Gene, I've heard you talk about seeing a concentration camp, liberating a concentration camp, which I'm sure to this day must haunt you. Can you tell us about that experience, when it was, what you saw?
Yes. The 20th Corps headquarters, of which I was a member, was stationed near Weimar, Germany. And near Weimar is a little German town called Ohrdruf. It's spelled O-H-R-D-R-U-F. And it's a small village, and our troops liberated it. But when they came to the outskirts of town, they were horrified that they discovered a concentration camp. And this Ohrdruf camp, it was discovered on April 4th, 1945, and it was the very first one discovered by American troops. And the commanders of the camp and the SS guards and so on had fled because the American troops were just outside the camp. So they had killed whatever people were left living and fled. So Our troops discovered the horrors there and saw all these dead bodies and corpses all over the place. And General Eisenhower was notified, and he and General Marshall went over there, along with General Patton, and they saw it. And Eisenhower immediately made a decision that he wanted all troops who were stationed in the vicinity of this camp to go there, because Ike wanted eyewitnesses.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was like a week later or so. Eisenhower also said that all the corpses should be left lying there because he, even though they were dead, he wanted everyone to see this. And Eisenhower had a lot of foresight because he thought that down the road history would say, oh, there was no such thing as a Holocaust, no such thing as concentration camps and the horrors of it. But he wanted eyewitnesses.
Mm-hmm.
So I was an eyewitness, and I went with a couple of guys. We jumped in the Jeep. We drove over there, and it was a horrifying experience and one that has haunted me all my life. I could not speak of it very well, and still difficult today to talk about it. But as we arrived in the camp, the first thing we saw was a pile of dead men, maybe 15 or 20. They had been shot in the head. They were still living.
Ugh.
At the time, no, I mean, they were still living at the time that our troops were approaching the camp. So the guards there immediately shot them, and then they fled. But there were many dead bodies around there, and we saw sheds where they were piled up like cordwood, covered with lime, because lime is a chemical that hastens decay. There were ovens, and then there was a meadow behind the camp where I saw hundreds and hundreds of corpses all spread out. There's a trench, several trenches nearby, where they were planning to throw these bodies in, but they didn't get that far when our troops overran the place. I had a camera with me because I was a photography buff. I carried a camera through the war, and I took a lot of pictures. So I have pictures.
Oh, you do?
Of these corpses.
Oh.
And all the things in this camp, order of camp. So I am an eyewitness, and I want to tell the world about this because Eisenhower wanted us to do that. And it's something that, just so gruesome.
Yeah.
You can't imagine.
The incredible evil in this world. How much this remains kind of a murky time in American history. Did we have evidence? Did we have pictures of anything before April 4th of 1945, Professor Miller, of the horrors of the concentration camp?
No pictures, but lots of reports of the camps. I mean, Edward R. Murrow was making broadcasts from London on the basis of Polish witnesses and escapees, and so we knew about the camps, and there was discussion about bombing Auschwitz, for example, during the war, and the Allies, Churchill and Roosevelt, decided against it. They thought that it would involve the killing of too many innocent prisoners. And so we did know about the camps. At Auschwitz, three guys had escaped and got to Switzerland, and they informed the Allies in London, were back to Washington. So there was this is in the summer of 1944, so there's a furious debate about whether or not to bomb Auschwitz. But this Ohrdruf incident is really, I think, the most powerful one because, I mean, there's 3,200 naked, emaciated bodies there. And you know, as Gene said, these guys had to walk by. Eisenhower also ordered that all the citizens of Ohrdruf pulled out of their homes and shown,
really?
The camp. They had to go through there. Yeah, and Eisenhower wrote his memoirs that a lot of our soldiers don't know, you know, what they're fighting for, but now at least they'll know what they're fighting against. And he cabled Truman, who had just taken over. Of course, this is the month of Roosevelt's death, and he asked Truman to send over a congressional delegation to personally witness the full horrors of the camps. Patton was so upset that walking around the camp that he vomited behind a barracks building.
And how was
Eisenhower turned tail? I mean, Eisenhower said, you know, I got to see the whole camp. He was getting sick himself, and.
And how did the news disseminate to all parts of the world? Were there pictures in papers all over the world? Were people aghast?
Yeah. Although, you know, the interesting thing is that I talked to, in the book I did on the air war, Masters of the Air, I interviewed a lot of German civilians. And there was a sense of, of disbelief about this. I mean, I interviewed a woman in Saxony near Dresden, and she said that a lot of people just didn't believe. You know, they thought the pictures, they saw the pictures, and they thought that the pictures were propaganda. Mm. They thought the pictures were staged, mm-hmm. that, you know, no savagery like this could take place. But people in those towns around places like Dachau, for example, witnesses said later that, you know, in Dachau, you know, a lot of the citizenry would ride around their bicycles with handkerchiefs over their noses because of the smells of the smoke coming, you know, the smoke and the burned bodies coming from the camps. They knew something was going on there. I mean, they just had to.
Right.
But they, you know, and the prisoners, of course, were brought in on these, in these boxcars, traveling all through Germany. And I think there's wide knowledge of Germany in Germany of what's happening.
Mm-hmm. And Gene, having witnessed this and describing it as the most horrible event that you had seen in your life, how did you deal with what you saw? How did you deal with how man can be so evil?
Well, the professor just mentioned the awful smell. I can remember that, too, and that's one thing that bothered me tremendously. The smell of decaying and burned flesh is so nauseating,
mm-hmm.
and it was burned so deeply in my brain that I could smell this for several months.
Mm-hmm.
It just took that long to get rid of it. And the day after we saw the camp, that night, I wrote a letter to my brother, because I didn't want to write to my parents about this because I didn't want them to get so upset. So I decided to write to my brother and tell him to use his own judgment whether he should tell Mom and Dad. Well, by the time my letter got home, 2 weeks later or so, this was worldwide news.
Mm-hmm.
But my letter was published in the Clintonville paper, my hometown paper, and the company's newsletter where I had worked. And so the news got sent around that way. But I never talked about this story. I came home from the war and got married, raised a family. And it was only when my sons were, probably their 30s or so, that I began to talk about this a little bit. And now I do a lot of talking. I give talks to school groups. Things like that, and this is one of the stories I tell them because this, I still am a living eyewitness.
Yes, you are.
To tell this story.
Yeah, and I'm glad you're writing a book about it. We have a lot of people who want to join the conversation, and so we'll invite them to do so in just one moment. It's VE Day, 45 years ago, Tuesday, May 8th, 1945. One of our guests remembers that day very well, Gene Schultz, Wisconsin World War II veteran, author of the forthcoming book. It's amazing. He said he had a camera and he documented the war. He must have some incredible pictures. The Ghost in General Patton's Army, the name of the forthcoming book. Professor Donald Miller is a professor of history at Lafayette College, and he has written all kinds of books: Masters of the Air, American Bomber Boys Who Fought in the Air War Against Nazi Germany, D-Days in the Pacific, The Story of World War II. He has won an Emmy for the outstanding television series of 2010, The Pacific, which was one heck of a television series. He's won many, many fellowships, and he is an expert, of course, on what we're talking about. Our phone number, 800-486-8655. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now for our guests, and let's start with Bill in Madison. Hi, Bill. Bill, are you there?
Yes, I am. I'm sorry.
Go ahead, please.
Sleep the switch here. I'm sorry if I sound a little emotional about this. I wasn't born at that time, but I learned about it pretty intimately. My father, he had a rather, actually a whole family, sort of a strange history that my grandfather fought for the Reichswehrmacht, the Kaiser, you know, in World War One. My father was a sergeant in the American Army, and he was, you know, at the time war broke out, he was narrowly missed being captured by the Japanese. He caught malaria, darn near died. When he was well enough, they shipped him back to Europe. And he by late 1944, he was in Europe in Patton's Army. And he was a sergeant, and he was part of this ghost army. I mean, he was... You know, marching through Europe during one of the worst winters on record. You know, people were, you know, freezing. They couldn't get supplies, and so people were going without shoes, and they didn't have water or gasoline. I mean, it was awful. And they captured many, many German soldiers, and among them was a German major, who my father actually befriended, because it turns out this German major knew his father. And there was a kind of family connection. And so they sort of played cards, you know, together, you know, through the fence kind of thing. And he says he had no hatred in particular for the Germans. He was fighting against the Germans because we were at war with him. But he says he didn't have any particular emotional feelings about it one way or the other. He was doing it because he was a soldier, and that was his duty. But he was among those who discovered Mauthausen. And Mauthausen was it's a small city, I believe, in southern Germany. And outside of Mauthausen, a few kilometers, is a quarry. And near that quarry... Well, they used forced labor to man that quarry, and they had there was a concentration camp there. They kept mostly British and Soviet prisoners there, but also they also, I guess there was an extermination camp there too. And my father was among those who discovered it, and he was also had the duty of being a photographer. And he was one of the ones assigned to go through and document all of this.
So you have pictures of all of this, Bill?
God, I wish I haven't gone through all my father's papers yet, because he passed away recently, and I've got all this stuff, and I haven't been able to go through it all.
Yeah, it would be a good time to go through all of that. I want to pick up on how people justified this particular war. We hear... that this was a war where there was a great evil, and we knew it, and may have been an easier war to volunteer for and to fight with all your might. Was it a hatred of Hitler that motivated people, or did people see other people as just human beings? I guess I'm fascinated by what you put in your head that can allow you to kill. Professor Miller?
Well, I think Bill makes a good point. A lot of the guys who went to Germany, you know, were going there out of duty and not, you know, not with a lot of hatred in their bellies.
Mm-hmm.
There wasn't a clear knowledge about what Hitler was doing, about the nature of the macabre massacres he was performing. And until the camps are liberated, a lot of these soldiers don't begin to fight with hatred. I mean, a lot of American correspondents pointed out that... The only American soldiers who didn't fraternize with German women were the guys who had seen the camps. It was different, though, with Japan. I mean, you know, there you have the whole idea of the Yellow Peril. And Japan strikes at Pearl Harbor. There's a lot of racial feeling already on the West Coast against Japanese. And that war really became almost from the beginning a war of hatred and, you know, an extreme savage violence where there's racial feelings on both sides. Japanese feel they're a superior race, and we are, you know, the white race, and, you know, and they're going to, you know, conquer all of Asia for the yellow races and liberate the yellow people. Meanwhile, they killed about 11 million of them. But there isn't that racial component, that same kind of racial component in the European theater. And I think it bears out in the sense that when you went on an island in the Pacific, you went there with one aim in mind. You had to kill every Japanese on the island because they didn't surrender. So it's just one kill fest after the other. By 1945, we have fewer than 5,000 Japanese prisoners. In Germany, you know, the German armies, when they're defeated, they surrender. And in late 44, you know, and early 45, we have enormous, you know, prison camps, you know, all over Western Europe.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a different kind of thing, a different kind, you know, different kind of feeling about the Germans. I found the great correspondence. This kid is on Guadalcanal, which is, of course, the first big fight in the Pacific, in the late summer of 1942. And he writes and that campaign went on until January. And in the interim, we had invaded North Africa, where we're fighting the German army. And this one brother writes to his brother in North Africa and said, I envy you because at least you're fighting human beings.
Mm. Gene, what did you keep in your mind as you were fighting this war?
Well, I was 19 years old when I went in, and I was still sort of a boy, you might say.
Yes, you were.
But it was the thing to do. I mean, we were called to duty by our government, and I wasn't into politics that much in those days. And the other thing is, all my friends who were my age were gone to the into the war. And so when my turn came, I was drafted and went into the Army. It was an adventure for me. I'd never been away from home before, and this was something new, and I saw new things and did new things. So it was an adventure, I would say, until I got into combat. And then things changed, because then my boss was killed the 16th day after we entered combat. That struck home very, very closely. And other men I knew were killed along the way, and danger was so close and there all the time. And my attitude changed. And then it was, okay, now we're really doing business here, so let's get this thing over with.
Right. Let's go to Mike in Whitefish Bay. Hi, Mike.
Hi. I wanted to ask the professor, since Hitler had committed suicide, who in the high command had the authority to surrender, and how long after Hitler's death did that command come down?
Well, Hitler, you know, distrusted everyone around him, but the one person he really trusted was Emperor Dönitz, and who's head of the German, Reichsmarine, the German Navy. And so Dönitz took power at that point, and it's, you know, it's he that, you know, has to agree to the surrender. General Jodl, one of Hitler's, they called him one of Hitler's nodding donkeys because he agreed with everything Hitler said. Jodl took the surrender at Reims in France, and then there was another ceremony later on because the Russians, you know, protested that this isn't really the surrender because you have to have Marshal Zhukov there, and he's the triumphant victor of Berlin. So we flew a delegation to Berlin and signed another agreement with General Keitel, another one of the high command there, and he signed the terms of surrender in Berlin to both the Russians and the Allies. So there were two surrender ceremonies there, one in Reims and one in one in Berlin. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And the Dönitz is later, taken prisoner.
Thanks, Mike. John in Grand Rapids. Hi, John.
Good morning. First of all, I'd like to thank Gene for his service. I know you guys don't think of yourselves as heroes, but to the rest of us, it's hard to imagine why you wouldn't. But in any event, you kind of addressed some of the questions I had I want to ask Gene what it is actually like to be in combat, what it's like to train for combat, how they trained you to kill. What is it like when you get back to society and now you have to follow the rules again? If you could just talk about what that was like and in the context of being in the 30s and 40s, because it seems to be different today. Thank you.
Thanks for the call.
Well, our training was pretty intense. And I started training in the desert in California. In the desert training camp, which was established by General Patton himself, because we're going to fight a war in North Africa at that time. And then I had desert training out with tanks and infantry out in the desert. And then we went to Camp Campbell, Kentucky, and because war in North Africa was pretty well over, and now our attention was going to be in Europe. The terrain was different there, so we had different kind of training in Kentucky because the terrain was different, and very intense battle training with guns. We fired every gun there was. We rode tanks. We drove half tracks and all that kind of stuff. When we went to England in February of 1944, that was 6 months before D-Day, we had more intense training, lots of marches, bivouacs, and all that kind of stuff. So it was that kind of training. When we got to the Normandy beaches, and I crossed over on Utah Beach.
Oh, you did?
Not on D-Day. It was D plus 45.
Mm.
It was July 22nd of 1944. That was my 21st birthday. I walked ashore on Utah Beach. And then we entered combat on August 1st. Well, I was in a Corps headquarters, so I really wasn't out there shooting guns at the enemy, but I had an administrative job. But I saw a lot of stuff going on around us. And it sure is different when you're in combat. You're scared. You have emotions that go up and down. You're lonely. You have all these feelings. Could it be me? And especially when a buddy gets killed. Wow, does that hit you hard?
I'm sure it does.
So so it was. That's the way it was. And well, when we got home after the war was over, I think I just plainly forgot about it, put it out of my mind, because I was starting a new life.
Mm-hmm. What did we do with, and what happened on this day and the rest of this week to, and how many POWs were there, Professor Miller?
Oh, there were over 100,000,
you know,
wow. POWs. They're... You know, many of them had been liberated in the last years of the war. They're liberated by combat, and then the rest are liberated, of course, by the surrender pact. And they're taken to a camp called Camp Lucky Strike in France, and deliced, given meals, fed slowly, you know, because their stomachs are so constricted. Brought back to health. A lot of them are hospitalized long term in Europe, and they're. They're airlifted either to England or back to the United States, to hospitals or to homes. The interesting thing I think that Gene was mentioning, two things on that, is that it was a very powerful statement he made about, you know, the personal nature of combat. Every soldier I've interviewed says that, and I've done work on the Civil War, and we've all read Red Badge of Courage, and as Stephen Crane says, a soldier's first battle is really with himself.
Hmm.
How will I perform?
Mm-hmm.
Can I kill? Will I fight? Will I run? And that continues. And a lot of times you don't have a will to kill until others around you are killed. And then, of course, a hardening process sets in as well.
Mm-hmm.
But the other thing, I think, is that when a lot of these guys came home, Tom Hanks and I recently did a documentary for HBO called He Has Seen War about the return. opener for me because my father served in the war, but he never talked much about the transition. He said the same thing that Gene said. I just kind of forgot about it and rebuilt my life. We interviewed a lot of veterans who came home and went through that transition. And what I noticed in looking at the newspapers and magazines of the times is in the women's magazines, for example, women are being warned, watch your husband. He's a trained killer.
Oh, watch my goodness.
Around. Yeah. Yeah. These guys, you know, there was a feeling that maybe if we had a depression, there were reports in the newspaper that we could form SS brigades and there'd be a coup d'etat. There's all these crazy fears. And I had never believed it existed, but these were in popular magazines.
What kinds of magazines? What was it?
Ladies' Home Journal, the Saturday Evening Post.
Oh.
All talking about how difficult it's going to be if you train a person to kill. How do you train a person not to kill? These guys don't, you know, go through long training to learn how to kill, to learn how to fight, to learn how to survive. And there's no decompression process. There's no training, you know, for the peacetime adjustment. And will they be able to adjust? Well, of course, they did wonderfully. But there's the fear that maybe some of them wouldn't. A lot of towns, including towns in Wisconsin, a lot of towns wouldn't welcome GI reunion groups after the war. I talked to Bill Guarnier, you know, one of the guys who's featured in Band of Brothers. And Bill lost a leg in the war. And Bill said at their first reunion, they were, you know, they had a difficult time in 1947. They got together, and they had a difficult time finding a place that would accept them because there was a feeling that these guys, you know, might get guns and get a little alcohol in them. There's even some of the vets have told me that, you know, they had difficulty with housing. The Army would set up Quonset huts for them, a lot of times for the guys on the GI Bill outside college campuses, and communities complained, we don't want these guys, kids there, you know. They're young, they're wild, they're trained, you know, in warfare, and we don't want them in the neighborhood.
Ooh, I just have not heard these stories before. My goodness.
I hadn't either. I hadn't either. And Bill Malden, who wrote did all these wonderful cartoons of the war in Italy, and Willie and Joe, his main characters, and everybody read them in Stars and Stripes. Well, Malden came home and continued the series, Willie and Joe as Civilians, and his cartoons point out that, you know, a lot of these guys were homeless. The divorce rate was very high after the war. Lots of marriages, lots of divorces. And a lot of these guys in the first year, 1946, you know, during the readjustment to a peacetime economy, are unemployed. And many are considered unemployable because they don't have any skills except killing, especially guys that are trained just as combat soldiers, just as frontline soldiers, like Marines or the First Army or the Ghost Armies, you know, I mean, so they have no, if you were behind the lines and you had clerical skills, skills, as air traffic controllers and things like that, you were in a better position than if you were a frontline soldier. And only about 600 to 700,000 guys served on the front line in the war.
Hmm.
The Army has what's called a long tail, and 9 out of 10 guys aren't going to see combat and aren't going to see a lot of them. And of those, not many of them see consecutive combat for long term. So Gene and his cohorts are the great exception.
Mm-hmm. Did you feel as though you were welcomed home, Gene, or did you experience any of the problems that Professor Miller just outlined?
No, I didn't have any problems. My hometown of Clintonville, Wisconsin, is a small town, and everybody knows everybody, and we were welcomed home, and it was just a great, joyous thing mm-hmm. to experience. Of course, then, because I was still young, I wanted an education, and of course, the great blessing was the GI Bill of Rights, and so I got my education. I enrolled at the University of Wisconsin in Madison, and I had all my education paid for, including getting a master's degree. So it was a great my adjustment was not difficult. I plunged right into going to school.
Right. When is your book coming out?
Well, I hope late summer. It's at the publisher's right now, And one of the things is that because I have many photographs that I'm going to put in the book, you know, the old negatives, I have to digitize them, so it takes a little while.
Well, we'll look forward to talking to you when that is released. Let's go to, let's pause for a moment and we'll return. On this day in 1945, and it was a Tuesday actually, May 8, Victory in Europe Day was declared. The German forces surrendered. It was the end of Hitler's war. And we are to, the war, of course, wasn't over. It's still a lot of fighting on the Pacific front. We're talking with two guests about today, particularly. Donald Miller is a professor of history at Lafayette College. Gene Schultz, Wisconsin World War II veteran, author of the book, we hope it will be out this summer, The Ghost in General Patton's Army. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. More phone calls now. Bill in Madison, hi.
Hi. Isn't that true that Patton could have ended the war 2 years earlier if Eisenhower had allowed him to encircle the German troops that were trapped in northern France and Belgium? Is that not true, please?
Professor Miller.
I think there's a lot of truth to that. This is the American army is heading to the Rhine, and we have the Germans in a sack, more or less. And the question is, are we going to close the sack? The Canadian and British armies are advancing from one. It's a pincer movement. They're advancing from one direction, the Americans from the other. And Patton wanted to close the sack and trap the German army before they reached the Rhine. But the order went out from Eisenhower not to do it because he didn't want the armies fighting too close together. And, he, you know, fearing that, you know, there would be a lot of friendly fire and a lot of casualties. So a lot of that, a lot of the army that we fought on the other side of the Rhine in the last years of the war are troops that escaped, you know, from France and then made their way across the Rhine and then fought the final battle in Germany.
How many of those, we were talking about this earlier, I'm wondering how many of the U.S. troops who were fighting in Europe subsequently had to go fight in the Pacific theater?
Well, not a lot, because of the closeness. No one knew the war in Japan would end that suddenly. No one knew about the atomic bombs. So, mm-hmm. You know, you're fighting, liberation, of course, occurs on the 8th in May, but some guys got to the Pacific, but by the time they got to the Pacific, the Battle of Okinawa is over. It is over in late June. And that's the end of the island combat. From then on, it's largely a Navy and Air Force operation to obliterate Japanese cities through firebombing and you know, heavy artillery pounding and force a surrender like that. So not a lot of guys. For example, guys from the 8th Air Force who did the bombing of the majority of the bombing of Germany. A lot of these guys, including their commander Jimmy Doolittle. The famous Doolittle raid, are sent to the Pacific, and Doolittle mobilizes the 8th Air Force, but they never flew. They never went into combat. There wasn't time.
We go to Bill in Appleton. Hi, Bill.
Good morning. Mr. Schultz, I want to thank you for your service and also for your courage to tell this story. My father has passed now, and he could never get through even just a few minutes of talking about his experience. And it's a little emotional even for me. He served in the 329th Infantry and a Rifle Company, 83rd Thunderbolt Division. And he served in France and Belgium. And then after the war, and he signed up for the duration. And I wonder later on if you could talk about that. But in the late 90s, my mom and dad visited France and Belgium. And Dad was treated in Paris like a typical American tourist. Excuse me.
It's all right.
But not so in Belgium. He was stopped on the streets and asked, "Were you here? Did you serve?" did you help liberate our country?
Hmm.
Older people walking down the streets in a small town in Belgium where he stayed for about a week or a week and a half, they knew. They knew what our soldiers' service meant, and they thanked him.
Gene, your response to that?
Yes, that is quite true. I can tell you my experience. In 1994, which was the 50th anniversary of D-Day, I took my wife, Eleanor, over to Europe, and I retraced my military steps there.
Mm.
Our 20th Corps headquarters had been in 32 command posts, and I found every one of them. When we got to Utah Beach, where I walked across, and all these cities in Normandy along the coast there, where all the beaches were, both the American beaches and the British beaches, those people, those French people, love Americans. You go through those villages, again, last year, a year ago of September, I was over there again at the Normandy beaches, and at Utah Beach, there's a little cafe standing there next to the museum, and our tour guide, knowing that I was a veteran who walked on the beach, went into the cafe and told the owner that I was a vet who had been there. And he threw his arms around me and said, "Merci, merci."
Hmm.
And then he gave me a pen, a marking pen, and he said, "Go sign your name on the wall of the cafe." And there he had patches, insignia patches, of all the units that walked across Utah Beach in World War II.
Mm.
And there I found the 20th Corps patch.
Oh, my goodness.
And I signed my name. And what it was, that too was a very emotional thing.
Mm-hmm.
So to answer your question, sir, yes, the people along the Normandy area there really love Americans. And every one of those towns has the American flag flying in their town, along with the French flag.
It is a very emotional thing because our World War II vets are leaving us, too. All of these firsthand accounts, all of their heroism, we just need to hear as much as we can, don't we, Professor Miller?
Yeah, I mean, I went to Normandy on a number of occasions with veterans, and once the locals found out that they were veterans, these guys were mobbed like rock stars.
Oh.
I mean, absolutely incredible. I went with a guy from the 82nd Airborne from Minnesota, Bill Bowles, and we went up to an old chateau, you know, on the cliffs above Normandy, and he was hidden, you know, by this family in their barn, and the woman, the young girl at the time, 16 years old, who hid him, she was there. She was grandma, and the whole family, 14 of them, came out to had a reunion with pictures and everything else, and it was just thrilling, you know, to be along for the emotional ride.
Yeah. All right, Bill, take a deep breath here. Mike in Appleton, hi. We only have about a minute left, Mike. Are you there, Mike? All right, Chris in Grafton. Hi.
Hi, Kathleen. Thanks for the excellent show. I did hear a caller earlier mention the camp, the forced labor camp, Mauthausen. And I just want to add, I took my family to that camp as we were in Germany and Austria. That camp is actually in Austria. It's a little tiny town, and the quarry was right on the edge of that camp, and they have beautiful respectful plaques about all those that were deceased and abused in the camp there today. And in this quarry, they had about a 100-step stairwell to get out of the pit of the quarry, and they called it the Stairway of Tears in respect for all the people that labored there. And it was a great sight. And so just wanted to add that, and thank you for the show today.
Thank you so much for your call, Chris. Well, gentlemen, I hate to let both of you go, but I know that we will speak again. Please, Gene, let us be among the first to know when that book is out. We would love to interview you.
Okay, thank you very much.
We sure would. And Professor Miller, a great pleasure to speak with you, sir. We've just sort of touched the surface here. There's so much. So
yeah, it's been wonderful to be on the show and just to be in the presence telephonically of Gene, you know.
Right. I agree. It's been great to be in his presence and your presence as well. Thank you. Professor Donald Miller is a professor of history at Lafayette College. We've got to get Gene in the studio here when that book comes out and talk to him face-to-face, right? All right. I guess we have to move on. Thank you to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour. Thanks to Brett Jaspers for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. And thanks for your calls, everybody. Today, on this day, in case you were wondering what you were listening to, it's amazing. It was a Tuesday, too. May 8, 1945 was Victory in Europe Day, marking the formal end of Hitler's war. So that's why we did the show this hour, and I'm glad we did. Gene served in Patton's 20th Corps, known as the Ghost Corps, and we thank him for his service and for being with us. News is coming up from National Public Radio, and then we have another hour to go, so please stay with us. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.